Test, test. This is Dave Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center in Dearborn, the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. And today, which is May 22nd, 1986, we are in lovely Seal Beach, California, on the ocean, just south of Los Angeles, south and west of Los Angeles, I would say. Yeah. And we're in the company of Mr. Theodore Ted Peetsch, P-I-E-T-S-C-H, who lives in a lovely retirement community known as Leisure World. And Mr. Peetsch has had a long career in American automotive design, and we will ask him today to tell his career narrative in his own way and in his own pace.
Well, thank you, Mr. Crippen. This is really an unexpected pleasure, and I will attempt to give you some idea of how I got mixed up with automobiles. It seems I was just born crazy about cars. In fact, I have an old picture taken in 1915 when I was only 3 years old, and I'm looking at a car catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand why it is, but I've always been crazy about cars, and I didn't realize that, you know, I was too young to realize that cars were designed and it had to be done. Somebody had to make them look the way they do, and so. All my spare time, I was always drawing cars, and I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, on September 23rd, 1912. And my father was an architect, and my mother was a housewife. And I came, my mother, I didn't do very well in school. And my mother, I think, realized that I wouldn't be happy unless I was connected somehow with cars. And she happened to have a friend who was influential with some well-known people in Detroit who were I don't remember exactly what the connection was, but anyway, it ended up that I was interviewed in New York City in a hotel room by Mr. Ken Lee, who at that time was head of research at Chrysler Corporation in Highland Park, Michigan.
What year was this?
This was about 1933, the end of 1933.
What had you done previous to that? Had you done any artwork or mechanical drawing?
I took a course in mechanical drawing, mm-hmm. and I went to art school where we drew from the cast and used charcoal and whatnot, but I don't think any of those things had any connection with the cars. Mm-hmm. And except that, certain techniques, I suppose. But I didn't really learn until I got on the job.
But you were interested in cars.
Oh, yes.
You said your earliest recollection was a...
Sure. That was the only thing I could think about. And so early in 1934, I took a train and came to Detroit, and it was one of those typical cold, gray Michigan days. Mm-hmm. And let's see what did happen. Well, anyway, I ended up at Chrysler, which was only about 3 blocks away from. I lived at the YMCA there in Highland Park.
Wow! And so you went off the Chrysler plant
in Highland Park. Yeah, it's only about 3 blocks away, so it was very convenient, and I walked to work. And anyway, I ended up. I thought I'd be. I hope he's long.
What happened? What were you hired for?
That's the thing. I thought that I was going to be a big car designer right away. See,
really?
Yeah, I was very naive, you know. So anyway, I ended up in the blueprint room, trimming blueprints as they came off the end of the blueprint machine.
Who did you see there? Was there anyone that you remember that you?
Yes, I think the man I was supposed to be my boss was Ken Lee. He was head of the research department.
Oh.
But
did he greet you when you came in?
That I don't remember.
Excuse me, when you say research, do you mean what kind of research?
Well, for automotive research, yeah. So.
Did Chrysler have a design department?
Oh, yes, they did. It only had been in existence since 1932, and here it's 1934, so mm-hmm. It was brand new. In those days, it wasn't called styling, and it was called art and color.
Oh, with Chrysler, too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They copied everything from General Motors.
Okay.
Because General Motors was the instigator of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You probably know the story of Harley Earl, and he started formal design departments back in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only about 7 years old when I got into it, which was...
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, anybody that had a natural talent for drawing and sketching cars, and most of all, who had an enthusiasm and really loved cars. In other words, had gasoline in his blood, we
right,
used to say.
Exactly.
That was all you needed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a lot different from today. Today it's all very formalized, and you have the Art Center College here in Pasadena, and you have, you got one in Detroit now, I understand, and mm-hmm. in New York there's been one for a long time.
Center for Creative Studies in Detroit.
Yeah.
So you were, in effect, you were learning on the job.
That's exactly
right.
The way it was.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, I was on this blueprint machine, I don't remember how long, but it was really purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got off of that, and then Ken Lee got a hold of me, and he wanted me to be his designer on this car, which has been dubbed the Star Car. Recently, in those days, we never heard of that name.
Mm.
We simply referred to it as the Ken Lee Research Car.
It was a research car, concept car that you were working on.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And it was very advanced, and I think the name Star Car really fits it quite well because it had a five-cylinder radial engine mounted in the front and front-wheel drive,
mm-hmm.
and a tubular square tube space frame,
mm-hmm.
and it does look remarkably like a VW Beetle, yeah. But I think it's merely coincidence because you're given a certain package to work within, and you're bound to almost come up with something quite similar, you know.
But wouldn't you say that if it resembled the later VW, then it must have been an experimental small car, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. They
were
trying to develop the thing and with the idea of going into production, but.
Was there a market for a small car?
Well, that was the thing. They decided that there wasn't a market for it at that time. Gasoline was cheap, and
mm-hmm.
everybody wanted a big car. And mm-hmm. I remember the average American looked down on a small car,
right.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was at the wrong time.
Was Ken Lee director of research in the styling department?
Oh, no. He was not connected with styling at all.
Oh, what was his job?
Well, he was the director of the research. He was head of research.
Oh, I see. Research for the whole corporation.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay.
And... he had no connection with styling, but he wanted to have his own little styling department. I was supposed to get
the one. Okay.
So
yeah.
The funny thing is, they stuck me in a corner of a big drafting room,
mm-hmm.
and all these guys they thought of as, you know, they never heard of such a thing. A guy go there drawing pretty pictures, you know, and they dubbed me the cartoonist. That was my title for them. As far as they were concerned, I was the cartoonist,
mm-hmm.
and I had a lot of fun and.
How did he outline your duties?
Well, the basic body had already been done by the official art and color department.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was doing was doing front ends from the windshield forward mainly,
mm-hmm.
and trim, what about that? Because in 1934, as you probably know, they came out with the Airflow,
mm-hmm.
Airflow Chrysler and Airflow DeSoto. They both had a falling off nose.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided the reason that car failed, and nobody, you know, it didn't sell well, was because of the falling off nose. They decided that was the reason.
The waterfall.
Yeah. So my job was to straighten out the nose.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
So I...
You had no input into the original airflow, then?
That was done. I saw that in 1934, I guess, at the auto show in New York. It was the first time I'd seen it.
Yeah. What did you think of it?
I was crazy about it. It was ugly, but it was so advanced and so logical.
Right.
And it thrilled me. I thought,
exciting.
My God, this thing makes all other cars look obsolete.
Right.
And even though I realized it lacked a lot of, you know, it could have been a lot prettier,
mm-hmm.
but I figured, well, that'll come, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But instead,
What was the public reaction, though? Can you remember?
Well, it didn't sell.
It didn't sell. No. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. So
was there talk when you got there about it being obviously something about we've got to do something about this?
Yeah. Well, they started lifting the nose on that too.
They did.
But the funny thing about it was even lately, just a few years ago, I don't know whether you have seen it or not, but somebody has come out with this horrible accessory you can buy for a VW Beetle.
Yeah.
It's a dog. It looks like a dog house hood with a Rolls Royce grill on the front of it.
I've seen that, yeah.
God.
Isn't that good?
So they still figured that they're straightening out a nose is what the car needed, I guess.
So did you have precise instructions from Mr. Lee to come up with a modification of the front end?
Yeah, oh yes. I made a lot many sketches.
And what would model year be for that?
Well, I have lots of photographs and all from that time. It was mostly in 36 when they were, my photographs are all from about that period. But, of course, in 34 we were working on it.
Well, and can you, forgive me, I don't mean to keep interrupting, but can you give us an idea of what, and then I'll subside. Can you give us an idea of what your mandate was? Can you detail exactly what you were told to do to the
No, they're just general terms.
Oh, I see.
They want a long straight hood and this and that. I was free to do what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, on my own, I developed a line. Instead of, see, they had this one two-door sedan. So I developed a little coupe with a rumble seat and also a van.
Mm-hmm.
And they never got beyond the rendering stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have pictures of those, too. And I'm glad I hung on to all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
My God, this is 50 years ago.
Really?
And I never dreamt that anybody in his right mind would be interested in this stuff.
But, very interesting.
But I hung on to it, and I have all that stuff in my files. I remember the names of all the men in the Art and Color, and I have pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
any
really
of them
been
went
long.
On to
oh, yes.
Fame?
Yes, Bud, are you familiar with Buzz Gressinger?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen him?
Yes.
Oh, you did? When did you see him?
I saw him last year in Santa Barbara.
Oh, did you interview him too?
Yes.
Oh, great. Buzz is a great guy. He's
yes.
a very, very talented
was
man.
Was he a comrade in arms?
Oh, yes, and a very, very talented man.
Good.
So there was Buzz and there was Reese Miller, which you mentioned.
Interviewed earlier this, late last week.
Yeah.
Right.
How is he anyway?
He's fine. Yeah. He said to say hello. He said to give you a big hello.
Oh, great.
Sorry he doesn't get in touch. He said, we always want to get together, and somehow we don't.
Yeah.
You know? But
yeah.
He said he hopes to see you.
Did he say what he's doing or anything? Or is he?
That who else do you remember?
John Foster.
John Foster, yes.
And Herb Weisinger, he's passed on now. Max Wasserman, he's gone. John Chaika. Chika,
uh-huh.
And Bill Flageol,
Flageole.
Mm-hmm. You talked to him too?
No.
And Ed Sheard, he's probably gone now because he was older than we were.
Sheard.
Mm-hmm. And
well,
John Hauser.
Probably I should spell all the proper names and places.
John Hauser, Hauser, I think.
Well, it's quite a training ground for.
Oh boy, that was when I really started to learn, because those guys, boy, they were really some hot shots in there.
Yeah.
And that was when I really started to learn. I used to copy the techniques, and I remember the one day somebody accused me of stealing ideas. And no, I'm not interested in the design. I'm merely interested in the rendering technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot that way.
Did you? Well, when we get to that, perhaps. Were you eventually transferred into the regular Art and Color section?
Yes,
that
happened in 1938.
Oh, well, let's not go too fast.
Yeah.
What happened to you in 34 to 38? That's what we're reading about.
Well, of course, it started with the blueprint room and then with Ken Lee.
Uh-huh.
And I was with Ken Lee up until the time I got transferred into the...
So you're there almost 4 years?
Yeah.
So that's a long 4 years. What sort of projects did he have you working on?
Well, it was always that same car.
Was it?
Yeah, that was the only thing.
Which one?
The Star Car. The little.
Tell us a little bit about the Star Car. A little bit more.
Well.
What wheelbase? What features?
I don't remember
had?
The wheelbase, but it was short. It was probably somewhere between 90 and 95 inches, somewhere
mm-hmm.
in there. And course, like I say, it was front-wheel drive and a radial engine.
Really?
Which was very, very radical for the time.
Yeah.
And this tube frame was about, the frames, the tubes were about an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter square, I think.
Uh-huh.
And the interior was, that won't be picked up. Will it? Yeah, she's got a loud voice. Well, I think this front window might be
open. Oh, that's okay. I mentioned the Star Car. This is the first I've heard of it. What did Mr. Lee have in mind with this radical departure?
Well, as far as I know, he just thought it that people would like a small, very economical car, you know,
uh-huh.
and
a radial just, engine.
Yeah.
I take it you did not work on the engine.
No, that was no.
Where did that come from?
I have no idea.
An experimental.
I think it was out of Ken Lee's.
Oh, I see.
He was an engineer, you see.
Oh, he was an engineer. So
research
he
engineer,
there.
Yeah. And
but he must have been really high on it or persistent.
Oh, he was.
For 4 years.
He was very. Everybody was very enthusiastic about it.
What sort of reaction was he getting from the executives?
Well, that's hard for me to say, too. But I know that people have asked me if I ever, well, this Donald Conine, who I was corresponding with, was doing the article.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me if I'd ever driven the car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never even got inside of it because the car was constantly in motion. They were testing. When they weren't testing, they were tearing it apart, you know.
I see.
But the interior.
You obviously got to a drivable prototype stage.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they drove it every day. And,
mm.
Well, really, really gave it the works. But the interior was severely plain. They didn't bother with anything. It was just severely plain.
Not that
something to hold the seats is all it was.
Mm-hmm.
But
was it similar to the later Crosley car, would you say?
No, I can show you pictures of it. If
mm-hmm.
you,
right.
Later, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's. Like I say, I think it was just very badly timed, and people just didn't see any need for a little car.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wanted a big car, you know.
Can you describe the radial engine? Did you ever see it?
Well, no, except, yeah, I saw it.
I
remember
right.
I remember the crankcase was a little pot-shaped thing that hung down up the front end of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the engine was ahead of the transmission, and the transmission was on the front axle.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it had to have U-joints for steering and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just looked like an airplane engine, a five-cylinder airplane
really?
Engine, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And it was air-cooled.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really...
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was.
Cylinders were in a...
flower conviction.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah.
Sitting right in front.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
of course.
It was at an angle like this in front of the axle.
Incredible.
It
didn't need a fan, obviously, because of
no.
air cool.
Wait a minute, it did have a fan, too.
Did it?
Yeah, it did have a fan. But I can't remember any radiator on it, darling. I don't know just how that was. And I've even got a little celluloid cutout of the engine that I used to use to put on my drawings to make sure I had room to work around the engine. I've even got that.
Yeah.
So,
well,
that,
for 4 years.
Yeah, that.
Exclusively.
Yeah, details.
Did Mr. Lee periodically say, "Don't get discouraged. We're gonna make it."
No, but I don't remember how it came. Finally, wound down and they dropped the thing, and then they.
But 4 years, Mr. Lee, that seemed like an awfully long time to be working on one.
Well. Not really, but
not
something brand new like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it started from scratch, you know.
Did you ever hear any scuttlebutt from anybody as to whether it would make any progress in terms of acceptance by the Mr. Breed? Mr.
Oh, we would hear that that man thought it was great. And
what about Fred Zeter? Did he? What do you think about
it? I never heard him say what he thought about it, but Carl Breer was.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember about Carl Breer was one of the biggest thrills of my young life. He took me for my first ride in an Airflow Chrysler.
Really?
And he was driving, and boy, we went like a bat. He was really going to show me what a great car it was. And
test track or out on the streets?
It was out in the, sort of, at that time, It didn't take long to get out into the suburbs.
That's right. Yeah, you were.
So we had Mound Road. You know where Mound Road is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We drove out Mound Road, and that was a big thrill. I don't. But somebody else was in the car too. I don't remember who it was, but anyhow.
Well, there was Zeter, Breer, and
Zeter, Skelton, and Breer.
Skelton and Breer.
Yeah.
Now, Zeter was the engineer.
Yeah. Well, all three were engineers.
Right, but
those were the three.
But Zeter was the
Chrysler's
chief.
Three. Zeter was chief. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what did Mr. Breer and Mr. Skelton do?
Well, they—I don't know—they were engineers too. That's what they did.
Executive
I don't know. But anyway, they were the three biggies in the company, and right under Walter P. Yeah, they were his right
hand. Did Walter P. have a chief lieutenant at that time? Like a executive assistant? Or?
I don't know who he would be unless he was these three guys.
No, yeah, they were famous.
Yeah,
because Chrysler was, except for the styling of the radical styling of the airflow. Chrysler was known as a good engineering.
Yeah, that's what they stake their claim to fame was on engineering, right? Yeah. And
what did you think of the Star Car? Were you enthusiastic about it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that, you know, heck yes, I was young, and my gosh, you know, if this thing goes into production and I had a big hand in it, why, it'll be a feather in my cap, you know.
So in a sense, Mr. Lee gave you a package.
Yeah.
And you were to flesh it out.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, that was it. We worked in quarter size models mostly.
Did you?
We didn't do any full size modeling out there. All quarter size.
Nowadays
it's 3/8, but in those days it was quarter.
Any of the quarter size models survived? Did you?
In pictures, I've got pictures.
You didn't keep the actual model, though.
Oh, I couldn't do that. No.
Oh, it wasn't considered.
No.
What? It has, does it have a vague resemblance to the Volkswagen?
Oh yeah, it does. Especially, it would have even more so, I suppose, to the layman, not as critical an eye, you know.
Uh-huh.
But the first car, I had to admit that an average person, even myself, I could see a great similarity in the two cars, the overall package and the round.
It
wasn't quite as round as a VW. But,
it wasn't a radical teardrop shape, was it?
No.
Uh-huh. But close.
But it was definitely better aerodynamics than the other cars on the road at the time.
Yeah. Were you conscious of aerodynamics at that point?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, that goes back hundreds of years. Do you know Alex Tremulous?
Yes.
Did you see him?
Yes.
He's a great one for aerodynamics. That's his pet. Subject.
Have your career paths crossed over there?
I never worked with him, no, but I see him every once in a while,
and
we never worked. Had the pleasure of working with him.
But I'm interested in this conception. Now, did this conception come from your fertile brain, or was it dictated by the package?
You mean, well,
the teardrop shape, or the
no, that was dictated by what came out of the
because
we had the body
the
on.
Shop.
Yeah.
Okay, what were you doing to it?
From the front windshield forward.
Okay.
And then trim details. Like
uh-huh. So at least the radiator from the firewall forward was your design.
Yeah.
The exterior.
Or my suggestions.
Okay. Yeah. So you toiled on this this exciting project for 4 years, but you never lost your enthusiasm.
Oh gosh, no! At that time, I was all fire and go.
4 years could be a deadening.
Well, it lasted a lot longer than my career lasted a lot longer than. Yeah. I didn't start to get fed up until about the last 2 or 3 years.
Okay, right. So what signaled the demise of the Star Car? What did Mr. Lee contact you and say that's it? Or?
No, it was never anything that.
Pat. Huh?
It's hard to remember so long ago, but I don't know whether they cut the funds off or what happens anyway. Anyway, they. I ended up in the styling department, which was where I wanted to go all along. And then, of course, from then on, I got to work on everything from the Plymouth Dodge, DeSoto, Chrysler, and Imperial. It was all done in one room.
Drafting room?
No drafting, just styling.
Styling, okay.
And then across the hall was under Henry King. That was the interior.
Oh, I see.
And then another big room was for modeling.
Uh-huh.
And Henry King did his modeling on instrument panels. In his studio. Yeah.
He had his own modeler, he did it himself.
Oh no, they had his own modelers. I forget the modeler's name.
Oh, that's right.
But
what about the exterior? You were in the exterior.
Right, yeah.
And you had your own modelers there.
Well, no, we were in the big in the big room, yeah.
Were they using clay?
Oh yes.
In those early days, like.
Oh yeah, just like.
Harley Earl, the pioneer.
Yeah.
What were the what were the in your case? You'd come from the experimental room, and now you're working on what to be production models. What precisely did you do?
Well, there it could have been anything from. You might have been told to design a whole new car, a whole new concept.
Right.
Of course, that was the ideal setup, and didn't happen too often.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we were doing hubcaps, and we spent an awful lot of time on front ends. That was a big thing.
Of course, that's because the key to the identification.
Yeah, it was, because
recognition factor.
The body, well, you know, like it is today, you put the same body on the Plymouth that you put on the Chrysler and so forth. But they did a lot better job in those days, because they had more elements to work with. They had separate fenders, and they had headlamps, freestanding headlamps, grills. You had a lot more elements to work with. Today, everybody ends up, the cars look like they might as well have come out of the same department. They all look alike. If you don't know how to read, you're out of luck, you know. That's an exaggeration, but we've lost an awful lot of individuality. And I think General Motors is especially bad that way.
But
buy a Cadillac and it's a little Cimarron, you know, it's a little, I don't know what people are thinking about.
But back in the mid to late 30s, you had lots of separate identification
factors. Yeah, the Cadillac, you could immediately tell a Cadillac from a Buick back in those days, even though they did have the same body. The fenders would be different.
Yeah, it would be different.
Yeah, it had its own character.
What about Chrysler? What were you working on then in 36 after you got off the Star?
Well, as long as I was out of that of the main styling department, I was on the Star car. That was anything else.
I
was.
But I mean, after you left the Star car.
Well, that was when I got to work on Plymouths and Dodges. And
who was the head of the styling then?
Well, Bob Cadwalder.
Can you spell that?
Cadwallader, I think.
Uh-huh. He was the chief of the styling
section. Yeah.
Where they trim and color.
Yeah.
Art and color section.
Right. And then under him, our immediate boss was Herb Weisinger.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
what kind of guys were they? Were they
they were wonderful, wonderful
were
people.
They?
Oh,
great. You take a young person like yourself, you get 4 years experience in experimental, to take them under their wing and.
They realized that I was learning, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that I'd been all alone and doing everything myself. And,
right.
And Herb had very poor eyesight. He'd get down to within a few inches of his face from what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
But his work was beautiful.
We'll see.
And sometimes his perspective would look a little distorted because he had to get so close. But he did beautiful work.
Did he?
Yeah. And
he was the assistant to the
head. Yeah, he was.
Was the head.
He was our immediate boss.
And then
Cadwalder was overall. I think Cadwalder was. As I recall, Cadwalder was over interior too, I think.
Probably.
And he was miscast, but...
Why, what happened?
Well, maybe I shouldn't say that.
Oh,
well, he wasn't very popular,
uh-huh.
put it that way.
Uh-huh.
And,
was
but
he talented?
He, no.
No, he wasn't.
Very un... And how he ever got that position, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Those things happen a lot.
Yeah.
And...
So he desperately needed Weisinger then, too.
Yeah, he needed all of us.
Yeah.
But it was funny, remember, he could come in, and he'd look over your shoulder what you were doing, then he'd kind of nudge you off your seat. And then he'd sit down at the table, and he'd roll out the vellum. He'd start screaming, roll out some more vellum, start screaming, roll out more. It was really a comedy.
What do you mean
doing these vellum was a paper we worked on.
Yeah. And what would he do with it?
Well, he'd take his pencil, and he'd scrub out these real rough drawings of what he wanted us to do. Well, he's big, heavy-handed, you know, pencil. And he was...
What was his object in doing that?
Well, he's supposed to fire us up, I guess, give us ideas, show us what he wanted us to do.
Oh, but...
And it got to be really comical. He used to pick on me because he knew I was the new man, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, God, he'd end up... He'd leave the room, and after it was all over, I'd get up and I'd show the guys, look at all this paper.
You mean he'd be trying to give you some visual instructions, and with his arm, he'd rub out everything you'd done?
He's for his own... he might be tracing over or something you did. He wouldn't disturb what you had done.
Oh, I see.
Done,
okay.
But, that was so funny.
What sort of directions was he trying to get?
Well, he'd get these pet ideas, and another thing about him was he was crazy about three red lines. Everything had three little red lines on it. And where he got these three red lines from, I don't know. That was one of his trademarks. You could have a nice clean design there. He'd want you to put three little red lines here. He was very...
Like on a fender or...
Like on a piece of chrome for the grill or around the headlamps, anywhere you wanted to put.
Would they survive in the final...
Well, some of them did, yeah. I guess some of his stuff had three red lines. In fact, that was kind of a...
Sort of a signature.
You saw it in the rest of the industry to some extent, too, but he drove it into the ground. He thought it was a hallmark of a good design, I guess.
I see.
And, those were crazy days. They were fun.
Mr. Peach, I'm interested in the Star Car, asking you a couple of final questions on that. It appears that, although you may not have known about it at the time, it appears that in the depths of the Depression, when small cars were being designed and built and sold as economy cars in terms of price and perhaps gasoline mileage, even though gasoline was relatively cheap, it appears that someone at Chrysler decided to try to piece together a similar small car, similar to the Austins, and what other cars were being built at that time. Certainly, the British small cars were being imported, and it looks as if Mr. Lee had worked with Mr. Breer on the radical five-cylinder radial engine earlier on, and decided to put a body around it and see if they couldn't market it through the Chrysler under the Chrysler nameplate as a economy car.
Well, that sounds quite reasonable to me, and it just was. Best of my recollection, that's just about the way it was, yeah.
But it was unusual for Chrysler because they had been certainly with the Airflow and other models of recent of early 30s vintage. They've been pretty heavy cars, had they not?
Oh yeah.
And very heavily styled and engineered.
Right.
Well.
Yeah.
This would have been a radical departure for them. I wonder, what do you think? Do you think it might have gone over if they'd tried it and pushed it with the public?
Well, I can only guess, but I think that like I've said before, that people just weren't interested. Mm-hmm. In Europe, it's quite a different story. They're heavily taxed over there, you know, and their
gasoline
tax,
yes,
and everything.
Uh-huh.
So there are a lot of small cars in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and it just wasn't needed at that time in this country. That's the way I think.
But apparently, there was a feeling throughout Chrysler that the effort that was being put into the development of this particular vehicle was at least a good possibility.
Well, Ken Lee had a lot of influence. He was well-liked, and he was a very smart man. He was a brilliant engineer, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so the management gave him a free hand to see what he could do, and
mm-hmm.
and they got all the experience and they gained from this project, and they just decided that there wasn't no time for it, that's all.
Actually, there wasn't too much expenditure. Your salary and Mr. Lee's left hand.
Well,
what were you making?
I'm sure there was more than that. I think I made the fabulous sum of $75 a month.
Well, that was your first big paycheck, though, right?
Yeah. I think when I got upstairs, that was $125 a month. But $300 a month was fabulous in those days.
Must have been, yes.
Oh, it was.
Purchasing power.
$300 a month. Wow. You know, you're a big shot.
Did you ever ride in it?
In this
in the
prototype, Star Car?
In the Star Car prototype?
No, I never did. Like I said, the engineers had that car moving all the time.
Uh-huh.
And when they weren't moving it, they were tearing it apart to see why this or that part failed or how they could make this part better. And
I'm really fascinated by the fact that Ken Lee had sort of pushed this through single-handedly, has he not?
Yeah, well, he had the moxie,
the
people behind him, yeah.
Was he a good engineer?
He must have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently
he was a great guy too. He used to throw these great Christmas parties for us, and mm-hmm. we had a rollicking good time.
That's great.
There was a lot of, in those days there was an awful lot of, well, there was a lot of hell raising too, but we had a hell of a good time. They seem to make a little allowances where they can't do that anymore.
They're a little more lenient, you mean?
They were then.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I mean, gosh.
They say, oh, those crazy stylists.
Yeah, that's right. They got to be that way. That's what makes them creative, you know.
Creative people are crazy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All those cliches. What were the actual conditions in the Steinen studio that when you finally got in, you found a sort of certain camaraderie where you were accepted by the... by people like Buzz Gerstinger and others.
Everybody was real nice.
They realized you were the greenhorn.
Yeah.
Needed help. But they realized you had a certain natural talent that...
they realized I had a lot of fire, at least. A lot of enthusiasm.
What other conditions prevailed in the studio in those days? Did you have frequent reviews or crits or...
Well...
Or, shows or whatever?
Three of the walls were covered with cork wallboard, and we'd pin up our designs on those on this cork board all around the room. And periodically, the big shots would come in and look things over. Sort of their toy department. They used to come in and get a big kick out of it. And the funny thing
that exists to this day.
I guess it does.
Tom executives love to go touring through the styling studio.
And what was I going to say?
You remember any Walter P. Kreister coming through at any time?
No, not him, but everybody else. Breer and Skelton and Leader, of course. But they'd look all around the wall. And the funny thing about it is, there was one designer there that had rather, well, we thought it, he had a rather, his taste was kind of corny. He went for the three red lines and all that kind of stuff. The big shot. No. Cadwalader never did a thing except.
Oh, who was the originator of the three red lines?
I think it's something that he just saw it on other cars. Saw these
that
red lines.
That wasn't Cadwalader.
Yeah, it was Cadwalader. Yeah, okay. He was the one that ordered us to put it on everything.
Yeah. Okay.
But there's other man there. Anyway, the executives will always gravitate up to his room. His board. He was up in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
It all gravitated. Yeah, Ed Sheard. And they loved his stuff.
Really? He's very popular.
Yeah.
Why so? Was his technique
His taste was different. And he didn't go for the clean. We tried to make our drawings, our designs, clean and modern and feeling, you know. And his were all kind of fussy, and that's what the executives liked, you know. So.
I don't think you can say that Chrysler cars of that period were very flamboyant, were they?
Well, yeah, you recall what the 39 Chrysler looked like, the waterfall Chrysler, and the Dodge. The Dodge was covered with red lines in 39. And Cadwalader influenced those designs quite a bit. And sort of Ed Sheard, too. And I can remember parts and bits, who did this, who did that. And I remember when Buzz Gerstinger did some very nice fenders and taillights on the 39 Chrysler. And we had the first hard top on the 39 Chrysler. It had chrome, little thin chrome window frames, which nobody else had at that time. And what I was going to say was this... we put our drawings up on the wall, and they come in and look at this, look at that, and they say, "Let's try this, let's try that," in the clay room, you know. And they take it out and try it.
Okay.
But
it
got to be such a funny thing too. We call ourselves paper hangers,
or thumb hangers.
I remember one time there was a blank space up on the wall, and I said, "Watch!" I put a sign up there, "Watch this space." Always horsing around, and one time the guys, we had these form-fitting seats that were kind of had a hollow in them, and they'd hold water. And somebody poured water in my chair, and you couldn't see it because it was all. But I saw him do it, And I, instead of me going to sit down, Cadwalder comes in with a light gray suit on and sits down plop and has some water. I bet Buzz remembers that. And God, I felt embarrassed for the guy too. He didn't want to let on anything happen, so he got up and walked out. And we turned around, the whole seat of his pants was soaked, you know.
Oh, he found out about it later.
Oh, yeah. He never said anything. He was pretty good about it. I guess he was embarrassed, too.
Weisenberg was a pretty good supervisor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
How do you spell his last name?
Weisinger.
And you got along with him fairly well?
Oh, sure. Everybody got along with Herb.
Yeah.
He
was
stayed,
supportive?
Yeah, he stayed with Chrysler for a long time. Even later years, on my second time back, I guess it was. I went back there three times.
Mm-hmm.
My second time back, I think it was, his health had gotten pretty bad, and the management was quite humane and quite sensitive about the human aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to come in once a week, or he'd come in, no, not once a week, but he'd come in. But very often he'd leave before the day was over. He was so sick, but he'd come in anyway, and he didn't have doing anything much. It was very sad.
Mm, yeah. Creative guy, like
yeah,
that. Good,
yeah.
You know. What? So you're learning your trade, and you're being supported by your fellow designers who've had perhaps more experience than you have, not necessarily more talent. And you're working on bits and pieces of the late '30s Chrysler.
Yeah.
What else distinguished you?
Well, I only stayed there for about 2 years. In 1940, I had a call from Frank Spring.
Who was Frank Spring?
He was head of styling at Hudson.
Uh-huh.
And so I went over
and
there.
You heard about your work?
I initiated it. I took some samples over.
Were you a little restless at Chrysler?
Yeah, I was always wanting to see what was around the next corner.
Right. Uh-huh.
Get a change of scene. I found it very exciting. Not only that, it was the quickest way to up your pay, you know,
because
they were very stingy with their raises.
Were they?
Yeah.
So if they knew you were looking, they might.
Yeah. Anyway, I ended up going over there. And
What happened? Did you surreptitiously send some drawings over to Mr. Spring?
No, I went over to see him.
And made an appointment. What did he say?
He was a very he was a character too. There's a lot of characters in this business. I remember, he had a light gray suit on, too. And he was sitting, his office. He had pinup girls around. Can you imagine this? Executive.
Petty girls?
Yeah, all over the walls. And my renderings, I'd taken off my own wall at home, and I had glass on some of them. And around the edge, I had taped around the edge of the glass, you know.
Right.
And to make the tape was white. Well, I didn't want white tape. I wanted my tape to blend with the color of my or rendering, whatever it was. So I'd rub pastel on the tape. And he took a hold of one of the renderings and he sits it like this down on his lap, right across his legs, you know. And his pastel. I didn't want to say anything, you know. I was just a kid. And anyway, he took I could see the line right across his legs there where he'd sat the drawing. Anyway,
What did he say?
About that?
No, about no. Your
Well, he ended up hiring me.
He did?
And,
he said, I like your work.
Yeah. But I found out from looking at the rendering that he didn't really know what he was looking at. He'd look at a reflection and think the metal was taking a shape or something that wasn't there.
Did that clue you into that he didn't know anything about styling?
Well, not styling so much, but drawing.
Drawing, right.
But I mean, anybody, you're not supposed to have to be educated to look at a picture and see what you're looking at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I wasn't there very long. This was in 1940, you know, World War II.
Yeah.
And
What did you sign you to do?
For the World War work?
No, I mean before that.
Oh well, I was just working on the current Hudsons at the time.
What did you think of?
I like that step down Hudson.
Yes. When had that been?
Was well built and it was. It was a good car.
A good car.
I don't remember. This was 1940. Well, it's been right around that time.
Do you remember some of the guys who were there who later went on to other companies?
Yeah, Bob Cotto was there.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen him?
Yes.
He's in Florida. What did he have to say?
I don't remember, but Simon Ann Arbor.
Oh, in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, his daughter.
Yeah, right. I haven't seen him for years. He and I were quite good friends. Anyway, Bob Cotto, and there was Roland Taylor.
Roland Taylor.
Is that a name?
No.
Roland Taylor and, the names don't come to me so fast from that.
Remember a young lady named Betty Thacker?
Betty Thacker, that sounds familiar.
Uh-huh.
Was she there?
She was in the styling department, yeah.
Betty Thacker. Not Thacksby.
She later married Joe Orris.
Oh, I know Joe Orris, yeah.
She supposedly was at Hudson about that time.
Joe Orris was?
No. Betty Thacker.
Well, she
graduated from the Cleveland School of Design.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't remember her being in her room, though.
No. You remember a lady on the design staff? That would have been quite rare in those days.
Yeah, yeah. No, but now that you say with Joe Orris' wife, it does kind of ring a bell.
But you don't remember her personally?
No.
Yeah. So what kind of projects did they have you working on?
Well, that was the usual run of things, from hubcaps to interiors to everything. And at Hudson, they didn't work in clay so much. They did full-size plaster models.
Oh, really?
Which was quite unusual. Bob Cotto was a very good designer, but he principally worked in three dimensions. In other words, he worked in models,
mm-hmm.
which made him very unusual because it was not usual to done that way. But he didn't draw. He didn't care for drawing at all. Yeah. Did
very
you get that from walking? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. Very fast. Very good.
And yet he preferred to work with plaster rather than clay.
Yeah, and I don't remember what the reasoning was behind that, because it would seem like a very cumbersome way to work.
Was it cheaper?
As I say, I don't know whether it was Bob's idea or whether Hudson had always done it that way. I don't know. But that was one of their peculiarities there. And,
very awkward for the workers to work with.
Yeah, you'd think so. Anyway, that was when I got into the war work, and I was doing production illustration.
No, the war war work became what? Began about 1940?
Yeah.
And was Hudson assigned a contract?
Yeah, Hudson had an Oerlikon aircraft, anti-aircraft gun.
No, what was that first one?
Oerlikon, O-R-L-I-C-O-N.
What is that?
That was an anti-aircraft gun.
Is that the trade name for it?
20 millimeter anti-aircraft gun.
That was their first contract.
Yeah, and then also they had work on the B-29 bomber.
And that's a bit later, wasn't it? Not B-29.
Yeah, B-29 was the one that bombed Tokyo, you know.
But that was 4 years later.
Yeah, well, it took the time to develop it.
Really? They're working on it way back then?
Yeah, at that time there wasn't even one built. It was all on paper, all blueprints. And I had the job of... I guess others worked on it too, wasn't just myself. But we had all these blueprints, and then from the blueprints we made these perspective drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it was that many of the people on the production line were unable to read blueprints. So if they could see a picture in perspective, right away they'd understand it.
Uh-huh.
So,
of course, you spent, several months on the blueprints?
Well, that was just trimming.
Trimming
blueprints.
Could you read blueprints, though?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got that from mechanical drawing when I was a kid.
That stood in good stead.
Yeah. And this B-29 thing was very interesting because finally, after all this work with all these pieces were put together, I got the job of making a rendering of the B-29 as a finished airplane.
Really?
Nothing but these stacks of blueprints, you know. And it was amazing. The damn thing, it came out, I had a chance to compare it later on with the actual plane, because nobody had seen the airplane, because it hadn't been built.
Right.
And later on, when the plane came out, I got a chance to compare it with my rendering, and except for the fact that I didn't have the wing quite far enough back, it looked just like the plane.
Mm.
I had my wing too far forward.
Mm.
And they used to call, I think that's the plane they call, prostitute, because it had no visible means of support. The wing.
Who were you doing that subcontracting for? Who was the eventual prime contractor on the B-29?
I don't remember.
Must be Boeing, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose, and I don't remember.
But you don't remember, you, no. You don't remember seeing anything on the blueprints? Like
that anti-aircraft gun and that airplane, there was another thing, there was a Helldiver, two Corsair Helldiver, worked on that. And then I did a lot of photo retouching, too, for books, what do they call them, these handbooks
For pilots?
Yeah, for whoever needed them, I guess.
Mechanics?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, did quite a lot of that. So that was a very interesting experience, too.
But now, where was this war work done? Was it done in...
Right there in their plant on Connors Avenue. Wow, dirty plant. Well, one of the generals, I don't remember what general it was, toured the plant. He said it was the dirtiest defense plant in the country. Mm-hmm. Right after that, they started squirting some paint around trying to clean the place
up.
But it was, excuse me, it was terrible. In those days, we didn't have any air conditioning. And so we had to open the windows.
Right.
And that was a dirty part of town anyways, Connors Avenue. The wind would come down Connors Avenue and that soot would come in the open windows, you know, where we were working up on the second floor. And gosh, your arms would get full of soot. You couldn't keep your drawings clean. It was awful. Really, really primitive.
What, everybody was burning soft coal, I suppose.
I must have been, yeah.
And there was no protection.
No.
Did you, by this time, had the war work, of course, did not cancel out civilian cars until about 1942.
The last cars were built in 1942. And those are the ones that had all the chrome painted out. And,
was that a defense?
Yeah, to save chrome was needed for the defense program. So
what for?
I don't know.
Yeah. But anyway, it was a scarce metal, and they decided to take it off the cars.
Yeah, right.
So the last year or so, it was distinguished by an absence of chrome.
Yeah, I remember Hudson at that time. I think it was at that time. Had a shortage of bumpers for some reason or other, so they were delivering the cars with 2x4s in place of the bumpers as a temporary thing until they could get bumpers.
Uh-huh.
But that's something you don't see happen.
Did they finally manufacture bumpers without chrome? Just simply this?
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah.
Chrome was simply decoration.
Oh yeah, sure.
Slight protection.
Now that's another very interesting thing. Back in those early days, most of the designers hated, but they liked chrome, but they liked it used judiciously. They didn't like it slapped on,
right.
You know, like they did in those days. And we were always trying to minimize the chrome and make the form of the car make more of the statement than the decoration that was on the surface. So it's interesting to note that nowadays they're going that way. Finally,
mm-hmm.
You see a lot less chrome on cars now than you did.
Yeah.
And see what else here.
So this is about 1940 when the war work began.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Were you in any danger of being drafted at that point?
Well, every time you came up, how was that? You came up, you had to be deferred,
mm-hmm.
And we were constantly in fear that the big arm was going to come out and grab you. Yeah.
But your number was coming.
Yeah, up. Right. And if you were in war work, you were deferred. But they were always reviewing everybody, you know.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Keep you worried.
So yeah. Hudson kept deferring you. Which is good.
Yeah, yeah.
They felt you were essential to the war effort.
Apparently, yeah. So we escaped that.
Yeah. What happened beyond the early drawings for the B-29 is fascinating. They were thinking of a super bomber even as far as back as 1940.
Yeah.
Where they had to make do with the flying fortresses and later. Then the B-24 Liberator, of course, was being projected then at that time, both in San Diego and in Willow Run.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Yeah.
Did you have any intimation? What was going on with the other car companies on stage? Any cross-fertilization between designers? Friends? Or
The only company that kept pretty much to itself was General Motors.
Uh-huh.
They considered themselves a little bit better. Well, that's the impression we always got.
Sure.
And most of us thought that they did turn out the best designs too.
Uh-huh.
Harley Earl had a 6'4" giant, you know,
mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of he was a great salesman, and he could really push his stuff and get it through.
Yeah.
And we didn't have anybody that had that kind of moxie to push our things.
How about Frank Spring? He was kind of a moxie.
Well, he was a very strange person. He was a pilot too. You know, he flew his own airplane.
Did he?
And he'd come to work on a motorcycle.
Uh-huh. Still a novelty in those days.
Oh gosh, even today it would be for the chief executive of the, department to come to work on a motorcycle.
Right.
But he was finally killed on a motorcycle, I think,
really?
Or with a sports car. I don't remember. But he loved fast cars, and he loved motor anything, I guess, that was fast. He liked it. And
strange, he never did a Hudson sports car.
Well, they did that Italia. I remember the Hudson Italia.
Oh, tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, I don't know anything about it much except that it was built in Italy.
Uh-huh.
And
what period was this? Late 30s?
I hesitate to say because I might be off on that.
Well, roughly. Before the war?
Yeah, it was just after the war, I think.
Oh,
I think.
Immediate post war.
I think so, yeah.
Was Spring still there?
When did I leave there? I left in 1947. So
Spring
I was there a long time.
I
think he was, yeah. Yeah.
So he had a feeling for fast cars and sporty cars, but yet he was pretty much, except for the step down Hudson, he's trapped pretty much in a fairly conventional car.
Right, yeah. Well, the Terraplane,
that was probably
the Essex Terraplane was a nice little car.
Yeah,
the convertible
right.
was very nice. And another thing he did that was
Essex
really
was
beautiful.
The top line or a bottom line?
The Essex was the lower line.
The lower line.
Yeah, the Hudson
but
was the top.
They came up with the Terraplane. Can you describe that a bit?
Well, except that it was good looking, and the convertible was the best looking one.
Was it?
I thought.
Uh-huh. So that was the closest he came to a sporting car, I suspect.
Yeah, but he did one very beautiful car on the Peerless sedan, which is in a museum somewhere now. I forget. Peerless, P-E-R. How do you spell Peerless? P-E-E-R. I don't know how do you spell Peerless.
What was it referring?
Peerless means it's the best, you know. Nothing.
Periel.
Peerless.
Oh, Peerless.
Yeah.
Oh, you said Peerless. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
P-E-E-P-E-P-E-R-L-E-S-S.
That must be right. That's how it
is. Did he do the Peerless?
He did that one. He's always given credit for it, at least.
Went off.
The doors rolled into the roof. It was a beautiful car. And it's still around. It's in some museum. I can't remember what museum it's in.
It's in a car museum in Cleveland.
McMinn would know.
Yeah. What,
in Cleveland, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would Hershey have been involved with that? Frankly?
He might have been.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah.
He might have
Did
been.
You know him?
I never met him.
But was he at? Was he there?
He's one of the founders of LeBaron, you know, one of LeBaron body. He's like I told you on the phone. He's one of the. He's a legendary figure in the
uh-huh.
in the business.
Did he have anything to do with the Peerless?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know. Frank Spring is always the one that's given credit for it. It's just like the Cord. It's always Buick, you know.
Yeah, but Spring wasn't a designer, was he?
Well,
or was he?
He called himself one. Here, that's another thing. How a man that seemed to have so little talent design-wise could be credited with such a beautiful creation, I don't know. But that's happened more than once, too. You wonder, well, my God, if he did that, how come he can't do anything now? You know? But
well, I suspect that was traditional in those days, that the chief executive got the credit. And
well,
the
of course.
Was sort of a faceless character.
Yeah, of course it's still that way. And I worked for Raymond Loy, for instance. You see something designed by Raymond Loy. Well, it's not designed by Raymond Loy. It's designed by his crew, his people.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in any event, you're deep in war work at Hudson. What happened when war was declared and into the war? Did you stay there?
Just stayed on doing it.
What other projects did you work on? What other war material?
Those are the only ones I can remember. But there was so much detail, especially on that B-29.
Oh,
keep you going for years, you
yes,
know.
Yes, right.
And I remember the ball turret. Boy, was that a bear to draw. It was a big ball and all kinds of structure in it, you know. And
there was one on the bottom and at the top?
Yeah.
Of the fuselage? Was there one in the rear also?
I believe there was. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, that was the tail gunner, but the ball turret was either the top or the bottom.
Yeah.
To intercept planes coming up from
yeah.
below, and fighter planes and diving from out of the sun.
Yeah. I was.
Did you design that particular?
Oh, no, no. All I did was interpret the blueprints into perspective drawings.
That came from the engineering department.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So it's, you spent an awful lot of time, on years, in fact, on detail work for that supercar.
Yeah, yeah. It got so that, my gosh, you wonder, how can I draw without a blueprint, you know? Mm. But I think it was a big help, because there's so many people on the production line that just couldn't read a blueprint, you know? Mm-hmm. And this was immediately apparent if you show them a picture.
So you were the catalyst between the blueprint and the production.
Yeah.
You showed them the perspective.
Yeah, right. Me and the rest of the guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was fun. It was an interesting time for you, and you were deferred throughout the war.
Yeah. Yeah.